Charm of Favor, Chapter 8.
Jack Rousseau's senior gym coach was also the social studies teacher. But Tom Larson was no ordinary coach, and he certainly was no ordinary teacher. Mr. Larson was a coach and the veteran son of a retired three-star general. While his father's command group moved from one facility to another, Mr. Larson showed his incredible talent for golf by teaching the officers' wives how to better play the game. It began at the age of 19 when his father moved to an air training command base in Denver, Colorado. While riding the shuttle bus one day from the Airmen's Club, after drinking a couple of pitchers of beer, he boasted of his expertise at golf. The base golf pro happened to be on that same bus. Within a few brags back and forth, the bus had a nice pot of about $300 to see the two battle it out on the beautifully manicured base golf course. Mr. Larson had never seen the course, was wearing shorts and sneakers, and had to rent a set of clubs. Nevertheless, within 9 holes, the wagers changed hands, and Lowry Air Force Base had a new golf instructor. The talented Mr. Larson also knew his American government. Jack liked him, because he would sit on a stool in front of the class and take his class to places in history like a time traveler. It wasn't just Thomas Jefferson handwriting the Declaration of Independence. It was the thinking and pacing that he made before dipping his quill in the ink. Each word of passion and vision was perfectly timed and laid onto that parchment. There were no erasures. There was no pile of crumpled, attempted declarations on the floor. It was perfection of a great man's soul, inspired of God, and dried on handmade paper that made the foundation for the oldest constitution the world has ever known. He also knew what government had become. It was this that fascinated Jack the most. The vision of Jefferson, Madison, and Adams reached as far as candlelight could take them. They could not see electricity or aircraft or the internet, but they had seen men who thought they were kings. They saw government so powerful that it removed all hope for nearly every living soul of ever seeing anything other than the serfdom their grandparents had seen. They also saw the wake of another intelligence sailing far in front of them in time. They knew it was there, ahead, digging a pit for the people about to be handed the keys to their own government. The founding fathers planted a government with 3 branches. They each had separate powers, with separate weapons, but they were equal in strength. In order for the tree to grow, provide protection, and bear fruit, the 3 branches had to work together, said Mr. Larson. It is no wonder they don't get anything done, said Jack without raising her hand. It's called deliberation. The finest steel is made from many blows with the hammer and the refiner's fire, said Mr. Larson. Then how come things are so screwed up? Asked Jack. I'm glad you asked that question. You see, somewhere along the way, as the story goes, someone snuck into the garden and planted something else alongside. Let's just call it a graft for now. But it's really not a graft. It took a while, but about 84 years ago, it burst out of the ground after wrapping itself around the roots of our tree. It has now become a 4th branch, said Mr. Larson. There's no 4th branch of government in our book, Mr. Larson, said Jack. That is a brilliant observation, Miss Rousseau. But that does not change the facts, said Mr. Larson. Allow me to enlighten you with an example. The United States Environmental Protection Agency is an agency of the federal government of the United States which was created for the purpose of protecting human health and environment by writing and enforcing regulations based on laws passed by Congress. The National Environmental Policy Act of 1969 was signed into law by President Nixon on January 1, 1970. The law created the Council on Environmental Quality that answered only to him. The council required that a detailed statement of environmental impacts be prepared for all major federal actions significantly affecting the environment. Nixon appointed a man named William Ruckelshaus as the first EPA administrator. Now, this was not actually part of the president's cabinet, but this new administrator had cabinet-level power, and it very soon became known in July of that year as the Environmental Protection Agency. "Yeah, the EPA. They're the good guys, right?" asked Jack, as though this was a personal discussion between her and Mr. Larson. "What you are about to learn here, you may not ever hear again, so I suggest you pay close attention. You should recall we talked about the Nixon impeachment. Well, in April of 1973, the fire under the Watergate kettle was being stoked by Democrats on every TV channel that could spare the time, and the whole thing was about to boil over. Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, and his Democrat affairs advisor, John Ehrlichman, resigned. Ruckelshaus was pulled out of the EPA and made acting director of the FBI, and then later, that same year, was shifted over to deputy attorney general. This was where the test of loyalty came in, said Mr. Larson as he slid off his stool and began pacing in front of the classroom as he continued. You see, Nixon knew what they were planning because he had raided their headquarters. Nowadays, they call that hacking, but in those days, it was done by breaking in and going through the files. They knew he knew. So Nixon ordered Ruckelshaus to fire the Watergate special prosecutor, Archibald Cox, who had been assigned the task of convicting Nixon. Well, he quit rather than follow that order. He was not loyal to the president. He was loyal to someone else. Or should I say, something else. After leaving the Justice Department, Ruckelshaus returned to the private practice of law. Very soon after that, he and his wife and five children moved to Seattle, Washington, where he accepted a position as Senior Vice President of Legal Affairs of the Weyerhaeuser Company, said Mr. Larson, writing with chalk on the board. You mean the plywood company? Asked Jack. Oh, much more than that. Weyerhaeuser owns more standing timber than just about any company on earth. They have an exclusive revolving door with the EPA, said Mr. Larson. He also served as director of a company called American Water Development. For generations, ranchers and farmers have worked the soil of the high, huge valley between the San Juan and Sangre de Cristo mountains. Five generations of water rights were now controlled by Ruckelshaus and his small group of powerful businessmen. Water means survival for those who can get it, riches for those who control it, and bankruptcy or moving trucks for those left without it. Disputes over water are frequent and often intense. More people have been shot over stolen water than over almost any other commodity. So it didn't take long before Mr. R. and his friends learned how his neighbors felt about their plan to sell millions of gallons of water from an aquifer below the valley floor to states across the West. It didn't stop him from becoming one of the most powerful people in the Western United States. You only thought being president makes you powerful. Now you see what real power is like. But I thought the EPA protected nature from big corporations, said Jack. Oh, see, that's what most people think. The truth is that they protect big corporations from competition from small companies, and they use land, air, and water to do it. We're talking trillions of dollars here. In 1983, the EPA was already in crisis due to mass resignations over the mishandling of the Superfund project. This was a giant slush fund President Ronald Reagan had set up to clean up environmental messes. I could tell you stories, but the point is that whenever the government starts throwing big money around, big corruption results. So, Reagan calls up good old loyal Ruckelshaus to serve as EPA administrator again. This time, it was White House Chief of Staff James Baker who was Ruckelshaus's champion in asking him to return to the agency. They gave him maximum autonomy in the choice of new appointees and refocused the agency on its fundamental mission. Within a year, the press and Congress got back in line, and on February 7, 1985, he retired from the EPA. He was quoted as saying, "At EPA, you work for a cause that is beyond self-interest and larger than the goals people normally pursue. You're not there for the money. You're there for something beyond yourself," said Mr. Larson. "Wow, I like when you tell us the history behind the history," said Jack, breaking her stare at the time-traveling teacher. "We have about 5 minutes left of class. I want to give you a glimpse of the real power in the fourth branch of government. I think you'll find it surprising," said Mr. Larson. No sooner did Ruckelshaus retire from the EPA, but he joined Perkins Coie, a Seattle-based law firm. You see, while he was being the noble soldier for the EPA from 1983, he served on the World Commission on Environment and Development, set up by none other than the United Nations. On top of that, in 1988, he became the chairman and chief executive officer of Browning Ferris Industries of Houston, Texas. You might know them as BFI. "You see, there are blue dumpsters all over town," said Mr. Larson. "Are you talking trash, Mr. Larson?" asked Jack, and the whole class laughed out loud. "Trash, indeed. You see, it is long believed that one of the most powerful organized crime activities in America is the collection and handling of trash. Where once there were many, now there's only one. Nearly every can in America dumps into a truck controlled by the largest multinational alternative investment firm in the world, Blackstone Group," wrote Mr. Larson on the back blackboard. "By the way, they are the world's fifth largest private equity firm by committed capital, focusing primarily on leveraged buyouts of more mature companies. In other words, they buy up the competitors." This guy, Ruckelshaus, had it all, didn't he? I mean, he had the trees, the water, and the trash, said Jack. What would you say if I told you he didn't stop there? President Bill Clinton appointed him as U.S. envoy in the implementation of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. He was that from 1997 to 1998. In 1999, he was appointed by Governor Gary Locke as chairman of the Salmon Recovery Fund Board for the state of Washington. And then, in the early 2000s, he was appointed by President George W. Bush to serve on the United States Commission on Ocean Policy. On September 20th, 2004, the commission submitted its final report to the President and Congress, an ocean blueprint for the 21st century. Since June 2010, he has served as co-chair of the Joint Ocean Commission Initiative. "Mr. Larson, there's no way we're going to remember all this, and it's not in our book," said Jack finally. "One more thing. Remember I told you about the executive revolving door at the EPA? Well, Mr. William Ruckelshaus serves or has served as a director on boards of several corporations, including Monsanto, Cummins Engine Company, Pharmacia Corporation, Solutia, Coinstar, Nordstrom, and Weyerhaeuser Company. He controls more than 27 million acres of timber, genetically modified foods, cell phones, and nearly all the fish in the sea that we consume in America, and is the director of the Initiative for Global Development," said Mr. Larson, holding his hands out wide as he could in front of the class. "He has to be the most powerful man in the world," said Jack. "He certainly is one of them. After all, before anyone cast the first vote for any candidate on April 17th, 2008, he endorsed a virtually unknown man from Chicago who had never had a paying job in his life, named Barack Hussein Obama for President of the United States. And the rest, so they say, is history, said Mr. Larson as the bell rang for class to end. I have to know, Mr. Larson, said Jack as she shouldered her book bag and walked up to him from her desk. Why did he pick Obama? I mean, what the hell? Asked Jack. We'll get into more of this tomorrow, but if you're really interested in knowing about all this, I think you should become an intern. You will get to see some of this up close and personal. I have an application right over here. Just fill it out, and we'll see about getting you in, said Mr. Larson, handing her the portfolio. My brother works as an asphalt lobbyist. He says they're all whores over there, said Jack. Well, if that was true, our nation would have been lost a long time ago. They always need good leaders who can take a punch. And in my book, good leaders come from good interns. You can take a punch, can't you? Asked Mr. Larson as he looked at the slight bruising under her left eye. I'll check it out. See you tomorrow, said Jack, stuffing the portfolio into her book bag and zipping it closed. Good participation today. Be good, said Mr. Larson as Jack bounced through the door and into the river of young people in the hallway. Math was always easy for Jack, so the final hour of school spent in the middle of algebra class went quickly. She pored over the application to be an intern for the United States Senate and had the blanks filled in by the time the final bell rang. She packed up her things, slid both arms through her book bag, and began the walk for home a mile away. Fair-weather days like this, she skipped the city bus and walked to stay in shape. Taekwondo was later in the evening, now that she was competing in a junior city league. It gave her time to drink a protein shake and change into what she told her mother was her combat gear. She had become a champion of sorts, mostly because a Rousseau wouldn't have it any other way, but also because it gave her a feeling of invincibility in front of people. Even during casual conversation with someone, on the outside she was calm and made easy eye contact, but inside she was imaging a maneuver to catch her opponent's advance and thrust him to the ground with her heel on his neck. She arrived at the dojo early, as usual, worked out with her age group, and helped stretch and catch the new students who were learning the sport. Maybe she could have made more money learning golf from Mr. Larson than history, but she gathered there were not many tour champions who could kick someone's ass in three jabs and a roundhouse kick to the side of the head. She knew her father was proud of her, even though he was trapped in a body that couldn't speak or write. She wondered if he could see the universe changing, because she was in it, and because she intended to grab it and push it around. There are two kinds of people in the world, Jackie, he used to say. There are those who are affected by the universe, and those who affect the universe. You're going to change everything. She wondered if she was loving him enough, and suddenly flushed by the thought of coming up short. She reminded herself to hug him long and hard the first thing when she got home. She stepped up to the heavy bag one more time and spun her hip to snap her long leg around to slap her heel against the leather level with her forehead. It crumpled as the chain above it jingled its complaint. Yeah, you better put some ice on that asshole, she thought.